listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And the FCC did it. Well, they didn't do it. They started. They took step two in what's going to be a long, torturous process. And all along the way, the American people in overwhelming numbers are saying, no! And AT&T and Comcast and Verizon are saying, please? And so, you know, they had their vote today. I find this very odd. The two Democrats and the chair, Tom Wheeler, the former telco lobbyist, they all voted to move forward with these rules that would create this kind of two-tiered internet. And, I mean, hell, it might be a 30-tiered internet before they're done with it. And the two Republicans voted against the rules and said, you know, it's not time to change anything. You know, we need to think this out, you know. And yet, yesterday when we were putting together the TV show, we went looking for Republicans to come on the air and oppose the rule, and we couldn't find any. And we ended up, you know, I did the Lone Liberal Rumble last night and with Kevin and Clarence and two guys who represent two fairly reputable conservative think tanks here in Washington, D.C. And they're both, like, totally in favor of what Tom Wheeler and the two Democrats did. And presumably, then, therefore, similarly, totally opposed to what the Republicans were saying, which is, don't do this. And I don't get it. I don't know what's going on here. I'm confused about the politics of it. I mean, I'm not confused about internet neutrality. And maybe the Republicans on the commission were holding out for something even better for the big corporations. Or maybe they're in bed with a different set of big corporations. Or maybe they're just doing it because it's the opposite of what the Democrats did, and that's their mandate. But whatever it is, it's moving forward. They refer to it as the headline over at the Financial Times, U.S. Rules on Internet Fast Lane Move Ahead. So, you know, we have that going on. There was a very emotional ceremony this morning at 9/11. They have this museum there. And we talked with Victoria Jones about this on the radio yesterday. And, you know, the reporter from the Talk Radio News Service, if you don't listen to the, she's in the second hour of the show, yeah. So I know sometimes people just listen to an hour because they're driving home or something. And, anyway, a very, very emotional ceremony this morning at the 9/11 Museum. Bush and Cheney weren't there. Anyhow, I'll offer my thoughts on that in just a moment. Right now, Senator Jeff Merkley is on the line with us. Merkley, Merkley, senate.gov, his website, and the Twitter at Jeff Merkley or at Sen Jeff Merkley. And Senator Merkley, welcome back to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you, and I'm sorry I was delayed getting taking care of that last vote there.
That's quite all right. Voting is good. You know, it's like important stuff.
Well, recognize we are actually voting on judges where there's overwhelming support for the judge, but we're having to go through an excruciatingly slow process as these votes are slow-walked and a cloture vote is necessary. And this is just part of the ongoing effort to paralyze the Senate.
This is Mitch McConnell's, I'm going to drag this through the 36 hours because you haven't been a lot. Harry Reid changed the rules so that they couldn't just block it forever. So now isn't it 36 hours of total activity between votes or something like that?
So not quite, but it's been reduced, but it works like this. If you're having a debate on a judge on a Monday and you decide to, okay, nobody has anything to say, let's vote. Instead of immediately voting, there's an objection to that vote. On Tuesday, you have to file a petition to say we want to have a vote to close debate. You can't vote on that petition until there's an intervening day. That takes you to Thursday. And now on district judges, we only need 2 hours of debate post-cloture. So you hold the vote on Thursday, have 2 hours of debate, and then everyone goes home to their home state for the weekend. So you basically one judge can be stretched out.
One judge a week, basically.
Yeah. It's
amazing.
It can be laid over the top of each other, as we're doing now, but it's a contest between trying to expedite things that should be taking no time and the effort of McConnell to slow it down instead of having real debates on the real issues affecting America.
Yeah, I refer to this as a Republican chaos strategy. They know that, and we saw this study from Mammoth University, 65% to 75% of all Americans have no idea which party controls Congress, either the House or the Senate or both. And therefore, but not over 90% of Americans know that the president is a Democrat. And so therefore, if the Republicans, the minority who can filibuster in the Senate and the majority who control the House, if they can damage America by preventing legislation that would bring jobs back home, that would help long-term unemployment, whatever, if they can actually hurt people, cause people pain, those people will blame the Democrats and the president for it. At least those people who don't know actually how it all works and how it runs. And they never get called on this. And, I have never seen a network news report about, for example, long-term unemployment that actually just comes right out and says one man, John Boehner, could simply put this to a vote in the House. And tomorrow morning, you would have all these people, 2 million people would have long-term unemployment benefits retroactive back to Christmas.
You know, and thinking about that issue, this is a program, the emergency unemployment, that was developed under Bush. It was bipartisan. It said when there is high unemployment, the average time to get a job is longer, so we need a longer bridge for families. They don't end up in foreclosures. They end up getting thrown out of their homes. This was a bipartisan, logical piece of policy, and it's been turned into
I am convinced these guys are trying to cause pain for purely partisan purposes, and that's the most... I'm not asking your opinion on it. I am strongly of the opinion that this is like evil. This is why they flip the stars upside down on the Republican logo so that they're the satanic stars rather than the normal stars. But in any case, you with the Senate Democrats right now are working to address college affordability. We only have a minute or two left here. Tell us about this.
Well, this is an issue that really goes right to the heart of success of our children. And right now, they're looking at the fact that college has gone up in cost faster than anything else in our economy. The costs have, and therefore disproportionate to a working salary. And I live in a blue-collar community, same community I grew up in. My kids go to the high school. It is very clear that the potential for college debt to be a millstone around your neck and to be the concern about being trapped between high monthly loan payments and potentially modest salary is dissuading people from pursuing their dreams and their education. And that's just unacceptable. So we've got to do a bunch of things.
Yeah.
We've got to lower the cost of student loans, the interest rate. We certainly have to try to control and perhaps reduce tuition costs. We need to increase the Pell Grants, but we also need to look at other models. And I'm putting forward this idea, this pay it forward grant model to replace the Stafford loans that could free people up from the concern of being trapped between modest wages and high loan payments, because your payments would be very low if your wages are low and substantial if your wages are substantial, but you wouldn't have to be worried about being trapped between those high payments and low wages.
That's a good step. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when college was free. Before Reagan got a hold of California. That's amazing. Senator Jeff Merkley, jeffmerkley.com, merkley.senate.gov. Sir, and I know you're also working on the transportation bill. I'll mention that after the break. But thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Take care.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And I want to continue sharing my thoughts about why Bush and Cheney might have not shown up this morning at the 9/11. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Nate Sweet on the line with us, international television superstar and producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Nate, how you doing?
How's it going, Tom?
Good. So, Big Pharma tax cheats and banksters. Oh, my!
Yep, we got Mike Papantonio on for our weekly Thursday segment. He's going to be talking specifically about Pfizer and how they scammed the U.S. tax code. Now they're in talks to buy a British company, British drug company, and it seems pretty clear that one of the major reasons they're buying it is to stash their profits overseas and rip off American taxpayers.
In fact, they're pretty much saying that that's the only reason they're buying it. And in fact, there's the huge blowback over in Europe about, you know, these guys are just trying to scam the American tax code. And is this any reason for our company to, you know, for one of our companies to get acquired by, you know, one of these dodgy American companies?
Yeah, and they're, you know, they're couching it in this language of, you know, we're just trying to do what's right for the shareholders, as if that's some sort of, you know, commandment that every business has to follow.
Well, it has been since the 80s.
Right.
I mean, you know, when Reagan changed the rules of compensation in order to do this, I write about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, I think. And it used to be that it was against the law in the United States to compensate senior officers with stock. And the result was that people, senior officers, worked for the four constituencies that they actually should be representing, which is the workers, the customers, the institution of the company itself, and the community, and the community that it is in. They were representing
the
all of those.
And the people who are actually involved with it, not people who are just making
right,
money.
Right, exactly.
With it.
And then finally, they also represented the shareholders, but in a very small way. I mean, you know, the shareholders just kind of had, you know, they had to know what was going on. And when they started compensating CEOs with stock and making that at a lower tax rate, so that became the major source of their compensation, all of a sudden the CEO behavior changed so that it now benefits the shareholders exclusively, and to hell with the community, to hell with the workers, to hell with the customers even. It's, you know, if it benefits the shareholders. And this is just crazy. We need to roll back that piece of Reaganomics. This was a rule that Reagan put into place, I think, in 85. And conservatives have been pushing for it for 25, 30 years. And it's been this giant experiment, and it has destroyed American capitalism, and this is just another manifestation of it. Anyhow, Pap's going to talk about that tonight. And then net neutrality. Tell me your thoughts on what's going on here.
Well, the FCC voted today, along party lines, actually. All the Democrats voted for the proposal, and the Democrats that are on the agency.
Right.
And all the Republicans voted against it.
Now, make sense of this for me, because last night both Horace and Kevin, who are conservative Republicans, were in favor of the proposal, and we, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not hearing, you know, right-wing talk show hosts talk against the proposal, and yet the Republicans voted on the committee voted against it. What's going on?
From my understanding, the situation is that the Republicans on the panel voted against it. You know, even though these rules will, in effect, kill net neutrality and create fast lines, they're components to Wheeler's revisions to those rules that say, you know, we're open to comment on regulating the internet as a public utility. So it's my understanding of the situation that the Republicans on the panel voted against the proposed rules because it contains those sort of giveaways to people who are concerned about.
In other words, it's not crazy enough.
It's not crazy enough. It's like Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court dissenting from a decision that Scalia wrote because it didn't take down all, you know, it didn't destroy all campaign finance laws. It's that sort of thing.
Amazing. And then we're going to be talking about the 60th anniversary of Brown v. Board coming up this weekend.
Saturday.
Yeah. Okay. Nate Sweet, thanks for being with us, Nate. I'll see you tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Okay. Look forward to it. Thank you. We'll be right back. But in any case, Mike Papantonio is going to be with us in the second hour. Michael Salzman, very interesting, a PR firm pretending that it's a think tank and getting published in the Washington Post. And, you know, I'm curious to hear what this guy has to say about the middle, the minimum wage. So we'll see where that goes. And, but. Just consider this for a moment. What made the Bush administration? I mean, you know, George Bush came into office, and for the first 9 months that he was president, there was a pretty broad consensus across the United States that this guy was not actually elected president. That he was handed this on a silver platter by the U.S. Supreme Court. by shutting down the recount that was ordered by the Florida Supreme Court. And there was actually a consortium of news agencies that were recounting the Florida ballot to find out what actually happened. Nobody knew. He didn't, you know, he was kind of wandering around looking kind of sad. I mean, you look at the inauguration. It was no big deal. It was kind of rainy and gray. And it's like, you know, it was just this guy, he was nothing. He was an illegitimate president. Turns out, actually, when they counted all the ballots, they found that by any measure, over vote, under vote, pimpled Chad, dimpled Chad, hanging Chad, pregnant Chad, by any measure, Al Gore won more votes in Florida than George W. Bush did. But the Supreme Court put an end to that recount. It had to be done a year later. And the results came out, of course, in November, which was a month after 9/11. So all the news media basically buried the result that George Bush wasn't actually the legitimate president of the United States, that it was Al Gore. Al Gore knows this. I know this. You know this. I mean, the New York Times knew it. They wrote it, but they buried it in the 17th paragraph in the story. And the story didn't run on page one. But all that aside, the thing that made the Bush presidency, that suddenly George Bush's popularity went from like in the total tank, nobody thought this guy was a decent president or anything else. The thing that went from him being nobody to him being, you know, having some of the highest popularity ratings since Franklin Roosevelt or Jack Kennedy was 9/11. You know, standing on that pile of rubble with that bullhorn with his arm around that firefighter who had been spending 3 days inhaling asbestos and making himself sick, and then the Bush administration refused to, for seven more years, refused to fund these guys' cancer fund, but set that aside. Bush standing there with that bullhorn with that poor guy who, you know, was soon to get sick, or at least he, his colleagues, I don't know, his individual story. I mean, the Obamas were there this morning for the opening of 9/11. The Clintons were there, both Bill and Hillary. They were there. I thought 9/11 was this big Republican thing, right? They got the Patriot Act out of it. They got, you know, $2 trillion worth of military spending out of it. They got Bush got reelected, you know, based on it by extending the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, he had told Mickey Herskowitz, his biographer, back in 1999, before he had even announced that he was running for president, when Mickey was writing the first draft of A Charge to Keep, George Bush's autobiography, he told his ghostwriter that if he was ever elected president, he would invade Iraq, and he wouldn't just make it a 100-hour war like his daddy did. I mean, his daddy blew it. He had all this political capital saved up, and he blew it because he didn't go all the way to Baghdad. So, I mean, you know, Bush was all about 9/11. 9/11 is what made Bush. You got that Cindy clip? Is that what you were looking for? Yeah, here's Cindy Sheehan quoting George W. Bush. Well, quoting Mickey Herskowitz, George Bush's autobiography author, quoting George W. Bush.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
And that's what he did. And, I mean, he didn't get everything passed. He wanted to get passed. But remember 2005, right after the election, he says, "I got all this political capital. I'm going to spend it now on privatizing Social Security." And the Democrats stopped him, but he tried. So anyhow, he was all about the war. So why did Bush and why did Cheney, who even, you know, brought down a full CIA operation, probably led to the death of several people, you know, certainly harmed our counterterrorism operations by outing Valerie Plame. Why did Bush and Cheney not show up at the 9/11 memorial this morning? I don't think that, you know, either one of them are ever going to show up at anything in public. I think, you know, for the same reason that Condi Rice is not speaking, you know, giving that commencement speech. These people are war criminals. It's not a matter of a difference in political opinion, the way Michael Smirkanish was trying to characterize it yesterday. They're war criminals.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It's why George W. Bush is painting pictures of himself in the shower in the bathtub, trying to wash the blood off himself. He knows it. Cheney knows it. They're war criminals. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And it's time to let them go. I'm serious. Time to let them go. Over the past few years, it's become increasingly clear that as long as far-right crazies and ultra-conservatives in Washington are preaching policy, and in states all over the country, are preaching policies that eat away at the very ideals our nation was built on, the American dream is going to remain out of reach for millions of Americans. In fact, the majority of Americans. So if we want to have, any chance of bringing back the American dream at all, we should just let those far-right crazies and the ultra-conservatives running around Washington and the red states, let them have their dream of their own country. Let them secede and start their own far-right, Ayn Rand-inspired paradise. Clive and Bundy, Louis Gohmert, Ted Cruz, Ted Nugent, Sean Hannity, the whole bunch of the America's far-right wingers, they could all move to West Texas. Create a country of their own. Free from the tyrannical influences of the U.S. government. They could even call this new Ayn Rand-inspired country Galt's Gulch, right? Why not? Run around firing their guns, not paying taxes, defying authority all they like. Yeah. No public schools, no fire departments, no police departments, no roads, no damn taxes. Yeah, it'd be paradise. Meanwhile, the rest of us in America can get back to rebuilding the American dream that Reaganomics has largely torn apart. But as Nicholas Kristof points out over at the New York Times, we may have to rename that dream part because the American dream isn't really the American dream anymore. Instead, we'd be better off living the European dream or the Canadian dream, because the American dream is pretty much dead. Here's what I mean. Just last month, economists announced that for the first time in history, the American middle class is no longer the richest middle class in the world. Canada's is. Now, part of that has to do with healthcare costs. While Americans still have to pay for healthcare costs with after-tax dollars, even under Obamacare, Canadians are basically getting free, untaxed health care thanks to a single-payer system. And because Canadians have access to life-saving and affordable health care, they live longer lives. Similarly, children in Canada are less likely to die than children in America, and American women are twice as likely to die as a result of pregnancy or childbirth than Canadian women. Get this. Canadians work less than Americans. The average American worker works 4.6 more hours than the average Canadian worker, even though they have a better quality of life and a stronger and richer middle class. Their CEOs don't make as much, but hey, their workers are doing fine. According to a recent report from the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, this is the 38 largest, most well-developed industrialized countries in the world. According to this recent report by the OECD, Canadians are smarter and more literate than we are, too, thanks to a vibrant, well-funded public school and university system. That same OECD report found that for people aged 16 to 24, America ranks dead last among wealthy and developed nations in math and technological proficiency. The American dream has always been about everyone having an equal shot at living a comfortable middle-class life, from a decent job to a decent retirement. Whether you're born in inner city neighborhood in Detroit or on the Upper West Side of New York City, the American dream is not supposed to discriminate. But as Nobel Prize winning economist Joe Stiglitz recently said, equality of opportunity, the American dream has always been a cherished American ideal, but data now in show that this is a myth. America has become the advanced country not only with the highest level of inequality, but one of those with the least equality of opportunity. Like Canadian geese in the summer. By the way, I got to tell you about the pigeon on my boat. Anyway, it looks like the American dream has migrated to the Great North. So after we've let all the far-right crazies move to West Texas and establish the world's newest country, Galt's Gulch, maybe the rest of us should join up with our neighbors to the north. We can create a new Canadian-American dream. Might be the only way to guarantee equal access at success and opportunity. You know that stuff that the American dream once promised? Could be. We could start with things like raising the federal minimum wage to $10 an hour. I mean, I had a Subway pizza. I thought Fred DeLuca, I think his name is, he just came out and said he's in favor of raising the minimum wage. Subway pizza. Raising the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. This is a no-brainer. So, anyhow, let them go. Let them secede. You know, increasingly, Louise used to, not used to, she still does, my wife, for years and years has said, Lincoln's mistake was fighting. He should have said to General Lee, okay, cool, you guys have fun. We'll have our own country. Thank you very much. And you go off and you do your slave thing and see how long that lasts. And then we could organize a boycott of them and cut them off from resources. And, you know, the North was industrializing. The South was not. Slavery would be dead in a generation. And the South might have actually, been forced to go through its own transformation. But anyway, who knows? I disagree with her. I think Lincoln did the right thing. I think, it's tragic it took as long as it did. But, should we have two countries? I don't know. Oh, and Macbeth, out, damned spot. This is the Clear Creek Community Theater. I don't know if you could play this from my computer. Can you? Pardon? Oh, yeah. This is courtesy of YouTube.
Yes, here's a spot.
Blood on my hands.
Damn spot, out, I say. One, two, what is time to do it?
Out, damned spot. Out, damned spot. Yes. Pretty remarkable. Anyhow, I think that's why Bush and Cheney didn't show up at the 9/11 memorial, because they know that they have blood on their hands. Both the blood of the victims of 9/11, because they were warned in advance this was coming and they did nothing to stop it. In fact, they stopped the efforts that Bill Clinton had initiated to stop this, because they had warnings that this was going to happen as far back as 98. So not only did they do nothing to stop it, but then they used it to start a war that had nothing to do with 9/11, Iraq, which opened the gates of hell. 5 million refugees, a shell of a country now, highest birth defect rate in the world because of our depleted uranium. We coated the country with it. And these guys are war criminals. Anyhow, Steve in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, just want to applaud Mr. DeLuca. He's got an outstanding suggestion there, and I hope he follows through with it at Subway.
Yeah. Well, I think Subway is doing it. I'm assuming that they're probably already paying that much. I don't know. Do you know, Sean? Or Shane? Excuse me. Yeah, okay. But anyway, yeah.
Well, that's a good thing. You know, in view of this fast food worker strike that's going on today, across our country, Europe, Switzerland to be specific, this weekend is going to be voting on a $25 an hour minimum wage. And we're just, we're trying to get basically 10-10 here. And I think that would be really good for the people. I mean, it's good for the economy.
I mean, Canada's minimum wage is $15 an hour, isn't it? I'm pretty sure it is. I'm going to have to look it up during the break at the top of the hour. Minimum wages around the world.
Than what we're doing, I'm thinking. But anyways, in view of some of this with the food worker strike today and the minimum wage on the table, there's a good clip by Teddy Kennedy dealing with the minimum wage, and it's called "When Does the Greed Stop?" I believe you played it before.
Yeah, yeah. He says, "When does the greed stop?"
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
If you do that, that'd be outstanding, Tom.
Yeah.
That's about
okay.
all I got to say, but thanks so much.
Okay, we'll have to track that down. Thank you, Steve, for the call. Dewan in Blacksburg, Virginia. Hey, Dewan, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Right off, love that new setting. For some reason, reminds me of Mr. Rogers.
Oh, thank you. It kind of is, yeah.
Where's that little train to the Magic Kingdom? So, hey,
I want to put two ferns in here, but they wouldn't go along with that. So.
Potted plants are great. Bumper stickers should be issued. So here, things have broken on the Radford Army Ammunition Plant.
Thanks. Oh, my.
To a reporter with cojones and the willingness to do investigative journalism, if you go to WDBJ7.com, then search EPA, you'll get their report. EPA, right to know.
Okay, this is on the ammunition plant at that should be a Superfund site in Virginia.
And Congressman Griffith saying he doesn't know what's being burned there, which is evidently a memory lapse.
Yeah, or, you know, enough money, enough influence, and people just forget everything. Go on. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for calling. Much appreciated. 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're going to track that down. I'm going to check the chat room here and see if anybody has tracked down the Canadian Minute. But somebody has. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah. Let's see. No, nobody in the chat room is mentioning the minimum wage. So, in that case, Jana, in Gig Harbor, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Jana, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just want to thank you so much. I quit my job about 6 months ago to stay home and reevaluate what I'm supposed to be doing. And I've been listening to your show almost every day. And a couple days ago, I had this idea about the topic that you were just talking about earlier. And it was seceding. And I totally agree with you. I think that there should be a push and a movement right now for people to form communities, to become self-sufficient. In fact, it was really funny. This morning I was listening to a podcast by a man of the name of Glenn Tate. He is, I don't know if you've heard of him.
I've not.
No. Okay. Well, you would be probably really interested in what he's doing right now.
What's he doing?
He calls himself a prepper, but not an extreme prepper. And it's funny because my husband works for a financial firm up in Seattle, and we've always been kind of, you know, going along with the suburban American dream. And lately, Tom's been coming home and giving me all this information about maybe we should start preparing for this financial collapse that everybody's talking about and so forth.
Yeah.
So this morning, he sends me this podcast, and in essence, this guy, he's an attorney up in Olympia. He's in the process of trying to create a movie to get the word out to the people that people need to start taking care of themselves in a different way. So when, along with that, I was thinking, well, shoot then, let's branch off, let's take the North again and, you know, join with Canada and, you know, start creating communities that are for the better of the people. And,
we could do so much, you know, to create resilience without the politics of it, just by giving people, you know, if we give people the same tax incentives we do to have children and to have mortgages, to have community gardens, if we gave community gardens tax incentives, if you have if you turn your front and back lawn into a garden, then you get a tax incentive and you no longer get a tax incentive for your mortgage, something like that. Why subsidize banks when we could be subsidizing food?
Exactly. And I do have a garden in my front yard, and my neighbors got really angry with that because it doesn't.
Oh, we used to live in a neighborhood where it was illegal. It's bizarre.
Well, and actually I thought that we were going to, you know, get a call from, you know, one of the homeowners associations, which we don't even have one, but he thought somebody was going to appoint themselves as that to complain, but they backed off. But, yeah, no, I do agree. And I also this morning thought, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, gosh, what can I do? I am forming a group of people. Gig Harbor is a more affluent type area, which my checkbook does not match, you know, the other people that live in this community. But I have a group of friends that would be and are beginning to talk about things like a barter board.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to start getting out there and talking about, you know, exchanging services for services and so forth. And, you know, it just feels like this whole fight against what's going on, I think, you know, we still continue to need to do that. but I also think there should be some energy put forth in, you know, the betterment.
And I thank you, Janet. If we did like Germany did and subsidized solar panels on people's roofs, so everybody would have their own electricity, and gave tax credits or incentives for people to have gardens. I mean, just simple stuff. We can make ourselves so much more resilient. This is interesting. Canada does minimum wage by province, what we would call states. And British Columbia is $10.25, Manitoba is $10.45, New Brunswick is $10, Newfoundland is $10, Northwest Territory is $10, Nova Scotia $10.40. Nunavut, which is the newest of their states, it's the native North American territory, $11. Ontario $10.25, PEI $10, Quebec $10.35, Saskatchewan $10, Yukon $10.72, Alberta $9.95, the lowest. What's PEI? I don't know what that is. Must be I thought I knew Canada. Anyway, we just had a caller. Jana just called, and she was talking about why don't we make, you know, pardon? Oh, Prince Edward Island. Thank you. Thank you, Shano. Shano, who knows everything. Or at least knows how to know everything. So Jana called and she was suggesting, you know, if there's a crash coming, why don't we work on becoming resilient? And, you know, I was talking about let the wackadoodles go, right? Let the whack jobs start their own, you know, gulch. But if we just did a couple of really simple things, like, you know, Germany had a day last week where 74% of all the electricity in the country was provided by rooftop solar panels on people's houses, principally. Because for 10 years, they didn't even subsidize it. They gave a tax break. I mean, you know, it was a sort of subsidy, but it didn't cost anybody anything at the end of the day. Because the electricity that was generated had value. So if we subsidize people or if we incentivize people to put solar panels on their roofs, totally decentralized our energy systems, and then we said, you know that mortgage deduction that you have right now for your home? We're going to cut that in half unless at least 3/4 of your lawn is garden instead of grass. Grass lawns go back to the British aristocracy. The British aristocrats in the 16th and 17th centuries and to this day, in order to demonstrate that they were so rich they didn't need to worry about food, they had peasants who grew their food for them, they grew grass. It was a way of saying we are snobs. And Americans have been growing grass by way of saying, yes, we're as snobbish as the British. It's stupid. I lived for a year in a little town in Germany, Stadtsteinach, maybe 20,000 people, 15, 20, 25,000 people. 70%, I would guess, of the houses in that town had their front yard and their backyard was garden. And this is the cloudiest country in all of Europe, and it's in a part of Europe that gets just a hellacious winter. We were in the middle north part, in the Franconian forest, in the mountains. So we had, you know, 9 months of winter and 3 months of bad sledding. And yet people would grow a lot of their own food. And if we just did a couple simple things like that, our communities would become resilient. Lloyd in Lakeland, Florida, listening on WMNF. Hey, Lloyd, what's up?
Hi there.
Hey.
Listen, I called to ask you if you're familiar with what Mr. Lawrence Lessig is doing with his May Day citizen super PAC.
Yeah, he says he just got people to give him $1 million, which I'm scratching my head on that. I mean, we're, you know, just instantly.
Oh,
really?
11,000 people actually.
Yeah.
Ponied up anywhere from, I guess, $50 to $1,000 a piece.
Right.
To fund that thing, and it had 30 days. It came off in about 13 days, actually.
Yeah.
The idea being, I don't know how familiar you are with it. The idea was, that if we raise that amount of money citizens.
He's then going to take that and he's going to go to billionaires and ask for matching grants and try and turn the $1 million into $5 million, $10 million, $20
million. Well, $2 million to begin with.
Yeah, and then become a political force. He's going to become, Lawrence Lessig wants to be Karl Rove. I you know, it's let's fight fire with fire. I understand it. I don't know Larry Lessig all that well. He and I were speakers together in New York City about 4 or 5 years ago about amending the Constitution, and we got in a small disagreement about tactics from the podium, which turned into kind of a food fight. And afterwards, I invited him out for a drink, and he wanted to have nothing to do with me. And I think it's been pretty much that way ever since. So I haven't had any contact with him since then. So I really don't know that much about him or what he's up to. But it just I'm wary. I mean, you know, if he can pull it off and it does some good, and he says he's going to try and get 3 or 4 people elected, and he's going to become a kingmaker, you know, God bless him. I mean, our politics are there's far more we have in common than we have in difference, and I admire his. He's like the Energizer Bunny. I mean, he just never gives up. He's constantly out there pushing. And, you know, good on that. He's a professor at Harvard University. And, but, you know, whether this is a good idea or not, there's actually a big debate about that in the progressive community. And Larry's, pardon?
Reason I listen to you a lot through WMNF in Tampa.
Mm-hmm.
And, I haven't heard very much mentioned about it in the media.
Yeah.
And, well, like I haven't. I contributed to it.
You did.
And possibly
good.
I wanted to go to the website and, you know, kind of look through.
Oh,
it.
I did. In fact, I probably spent 2 hours on that website and Root Strikers, which Larry helped start.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, Larry's built a couple of little empires here, and he's got a couple of books out, and he's turning himself into a minor rock star in the progressive side, which is all good. I hope this doesn't sound like sour grapes. He's not my favorite person personally, but I have tremendous respect for his intellect and for his actions. And in fact, if he wants to come on this program and talk about what he's doing, I would be pleased to have him on. So good on you for supporting him. Keep us up to date on, you know, what you see happening. And I'll mention it more often. I haven't mentioned it at all. You're right. And the reason why is, I probably because of some personal ambivalence, and I've got to get over that. I really do. So, Lloyd, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. We'll be back. It's the top of the hour. Coming up next, Mike Papantonio. He's got some opinions about some things that are going on.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mike Papantonio on the line with us, America's lawyer. An attorney with Levin Law, host of Ring of Fire Radio and Ring of Fire TV, website ringoffireradio.com. And they've got a new Facebook page out, America's Lawyer, over on Facebook. It's really cool. Hey, Pap, how you doing?
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. So you're pretty cranked about these parasite corporations. Tell me about this.
Well, I mean, the biggest parasite right now is a company that I've sued so many times for making products that kill and maim people. I can't even count the number of times that I've had to sue Pfizer, and Pfizer has paid already billions of dollars for people that they've either crippled or killed with their products. But now what they want to do is, look, They use our infrastructure. They use our police departments. They use our fire departments. They take their research directly from the National Institute of Health. We give them all that. We give them patent protection. We give them treaty protection. Our military's there when they need it. Our roads are there when they have to ship their product.
Give them an educated workforce.
Educated workforce.
Public schools.
We give them all of that. But, you know, that's not enough for them. On top of that, we gave them $2.2 billion in tax refunds when they've got $73 billion stored offshore. But that's not good enough for this Ian Reed, who is a true. This is not an overstatement. You talk about a bottom feeder of CEOs. It is Ian Reed, who is the CEO of this company. A Pfizer. Now, we're hearing this talk about their intent to do business with AstraZeneca, and they're willing to pay $100 billion so they can buy AstraZeneca. But it's not so they can do a better job for consumers, Tom. Pfizer has already shown that in the last few years, they're hardly spending any money on research and development. What they're doing is playing shell games with money. And what I mean is this, if they buy AstraZeneca, it's not about making better products for consumers. What it's about is they don't have to pay any taxes at all because of the way that the company's put together. They get to do business right there on 42nd Street in New York. They keep their building. They ship tons of jobs overseas in the process. But they get to have all the benefits of this country and pay no taxes at all. And so what's happening here is we have a government that's not willing to do anything about that. You see, we have a government that could do an awful lot. You know what we could do immediately? We could say, fine, Pfizer, but you know what? You're not permitted to sell any medication to Medicare or Medicaid. You're not permitted to sell any medication to the VA. And all those government contracts that we give you, well, I'm sorry, but they're all gone. There's a ton of things we could do, but we have an administration and a Congress unwilling to do any of that. As a matter of fact, this administration seems to be embracing this move, and it's very troublesome because already we see companies like Boeing that's been doing this. We have every company that wants to move out of the country for making money, but stay in the country for all the benefits that taxpayers provide. And it's a really ugly story, Tom. And for us to sit back and say we're not going to do anything is ridiculous. We know we can do something, and we have an administration without the conviction to do anything here.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, I'm reading about this in the Financial Times about how the European countries in the UK, the country that they want to take over, there are people saying, wait a minute, this is stupid. They want to do this just to scam the American tax code, and we're going to go along with this? There's something that I wrote about this in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, and it's kind of arcane, but I think this is the cancer behind the cancer, Pep. Prior to the Reagan administration, it was illegal. There were SEC rules against rewarding senior executives, decision-making, major decision-making executives like CEOs with stock. They could only take paychecks. And the reason was so that there would be no incentive to manipulate the stock and things like that. And there was a big move by conservatives in the 60s, 70s, and then it culminated in the 80s with the Reagan administration to change those rules so that the CEOs could be compensated with stock in addition to their regular pay.
Right.
And when Reagan changed those rules, prior to that, the typical CEO, prior to 1980, the typical CEO in America had been at the same company for an average of 28 years.
Correct.
They had literally worked their way from the mailroom clerk up to CEO. In fact, that's how it happened with the guy who was the head of the GM. And they typically made $1 million, $2 million, but at 30 times what their average workers made. But when they started comping, and they were acting on behalf of five constituencies. They were acting on behalf of the customers. They were acting on behalf of the workers. They were acting on behalf of the institution of the company itself. They were acting on behalf of the communities in which the companies were located. And then finally, and least actually, they were acting on behalf of the stockholders. And these activist stockholders, the T. Boone Pickens of the world, who pushed this thing through the Reagan administration, They changed this so that the CEOs now say, to hell with the workers, to hell with the customers, we'll sell them any kind of crappy product, we'll even kill them, as you say, with this farm. To hell with the institution of the company, we'll slice it, dice it, sell it, whatever, it doesn't matter. To hell with the community, we're all about the stockholders because we're now stockholders. And by the way, we only pay a maximum 20% income tax on this compensation from stock.
Right.
If we were simply to reverse that rule, I think a lot of this sick and twisted behavior would change.
Well, what you just described is short-term big profits, long-term loss and looting of the company.
Yep.
That's what this is, Tom. What you just described is what they call looting of the company. And now this Ian Reed is a great example of one of the great CEOs who knows everything about looting a company. If you look at what Reed has done with Pfizer in the last few years, there hasn't been research and development. That's why they're making products that are killing people.
Right.
Consumers are always at risk anytime you buy a Pfizer product. I got to tell you that. If that product hasn't been on the market for 10 years, stay away from it because of this concept that you're describing called short, big profit, long-term looting. That's
right.
What this
yeah,
is about.
It's, because his only interest is the stock, because that's how he's
right.
paid. And if we just went back to the old SEC rule that said you cannot pay, I think it was the SEC, you cannot pay senior executives with stock, period, anymore. You got to pay them a paycheck.
Well, here's where the stockholder really misses it. That CEO has a fiduciary duty not just to make money for the shareholders. You understand this. These are frauds. When you hear a CEO talk about, gee whiz, my only fiduciary duty is to make money quickly and as much as I can, that is a lie. That is a new concept where it comes to CEOs doing business. It's called the shareholder value ideology. It
right.
is bunk.
Right.
Because what you're saying is the shareholder ideology by a guy like Ian Reed means let me make as much as I can in 5 years, and then what's ever left as a company, let the next guy worry about that.
Yep.
And every time we see this, the stock starts dropping for the company, and the same thing is going to happen with Ian Reed.
Yeah, and this all started in the 80s with the Reagan administration, with all these takeovers and acquisitions and looting of companies and Chainsaw Al Dunlop and all that stuff, and it all happened because of that rule change. So anyhow, my own personal wonky little bugaboo is that is one of the things that has, you know, sort of like corporate personhood. You know, there are these things that are like the cancer underneath that most people don't even know about. And I think that's a big one. But anyway,
I think it's a good point. It's a great analysis. I had not thought about that being the heart of the problem. But as you spoke those words, it is clear that that is one of the problems.
Yeah. I mean, I need not go on about it. So what? Also, the U.S. Chamber is going after Dems in AG races, state AG races.
You know, Tom, 2 years ago, you and I were doing stories about how the new focus is on the AGs and on the judges. Chamber of Commerce is putting millions of dollars into this. They want to buy all the AGs so they can't be held accountable for their crimes.
Because these guys are the chief law enforcement officers.
Exactly.
Amazing. Mike Papantonio, America's lawyer. You've always got your finger on the pulse of what's going on, Pap. Thanks so much. Great having you with us.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Check out Pap's new page over at Facebook, yeah, America's Lawyer, as well as ringoffireradio.com. And welcome back. Mike Papantonio, America's Lawyer, still with us, and ringoffireradiocourse.com that Pap does every week with Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Sam Cedar and David Bender and a host of others. But he also does Ring of Fire TV. Pap, you're still with us, right?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, this week we got a great show. Farron Cousins, the great Scott Milliken and Farron Cousins, honestly, I brag about them all the time. Two of the best producers and directors in the business. They took over this week, and they've got a show that I think is an extraordinarily interesting show. What they're going to talk about, first of all, how the 1% convinces the 99% that they can take all of the 99%'s money and the 99%'s going to be better off for it. Very interesting story that they've got put together. We're going to talk about charter schools and the financial abuse taking place in the charter schools, where money's actually being stolen by the hundreds of millions of dollars, and you have an administration that wants to put another $300 million into that theft. We're going to be talking about the revolving door. This is a very ugly story about the Department of Justice, where the Department of Justice has gotten to where it's really no different from the FDA in that revolving door of scientists moving from one to another. Here what you have is this story is going to talk about some of the latest moves, like this prosecutor named Rahm, who used to work for Lanny Brewer, who worked for the Department of Justice, who let the entire Wall Street industry get away with stealing $18 trillion and nobody goes to jail. She helped engineer it right along with Lanny Brewer, right along with Eric Holder, and no surprise, she's going to work for Wall Street.
Jeez.
So it's a disgusting story. We have a Department of Justice that this is their way of life right now. And so we're going to be spending a little time talking about that. We're going to talk about how Canadian companies are using America as kind of the dumping ground for all of their oil industry problems, and we're the people that are going to be picking up all those externalities. So we've got a great show. Again, it's been put together by Farron Cousins and Scott, Gary Bentley and Scott Millick, and we've just got a great crew. And of course, Damien, who does all the editing and putting that show together. I'm so proud of the crew that puts that program together every week. They are all the best of the best, and you're going to see their quality this week.
And that's noon Eastern time right here on Free Speech TV.
That's right.
And that's on Sundays, and then it replays throughout the week. You can check that out. Pap, in the minute we got left here, Shano and Danielle told me about your new Facebook page, America's Lawyer. We've liked it. What's up?
Well, you helped invent it, Tom. What I mean by that is America's Lawyer, I think that notion of America's Lawyer came about because people would ask me from time to time, run for DOJ, the issues you seem to be talking about as a lawyer seem to be great issues dealing with American policy. And we kind of picked up on this notion of America's Lawyer, and it's a huge compliment to me, but I think people like it. So that is our new webpage.
I've been calling you that for months.
You have been, and that's kind of where this momentum picked up, because if you think about what we do in this law firm, there are issues that involve Americans' lives, whether it's going after Wall Street, whether it's going after the pharmaceutical industry, TTAM, you name it. We try to do the right thing, everything from environmental onto fraud cases that hopefully benefit the American public.
A law firm with a conscience, a novel idea.
Yes, we are that, Tom.
You really are. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com, and of course, every Sunday, Ring of Fire TV. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Twenty minutes past the hour, occupying the media and defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you, and Patrick in Park City, Utah. Hey, Patrick, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. How are you doing today? It was great to hear Mike Papantonio. That guy's on the ball, isn't he?
He really is. He's one of the sharpest guys in America, and he's actually having an influence. I mean, he's changing things, which is just incredible. So you wanted to talk about Larry Lessig?
Yeah, you know, I've been a recent, I'd say, very involved, viewer of your program for some time. I was a guest on your program. I made a film called Forward 13, Waking Up the American Dream. And I am a graduate of the Tom Hartman University from the crash of 2016. And I wanted to disagree with you on Lessig because I called you about a month ago to inform you of this thing. One of your callers had raised a question. What are we going to do? What is it going to take to galvanize the public to try to get them to move this incredibly coordinated and highly funded and executed, skilled machine of the GOP and the Tea Party and the billionaire-funded situation that is destroying us all that you talk about so eloquently every day. And I happen to bring up this thing. I'm not even going to mention what it is because you taught me a lesson then not to promote something that's not going to work, and I'm not going to. But my point is I did something almost exactly like Lessig did. And, you know, the bottom line was on that particular show, I felt like a criminal after talking to you. Like my heart was in the wrong place because I did want to fight fire with fire. And then Lessig showed up about 2 weeks later actually doing the exact same thing that I've been involved with for some time. And just to set this up one more minute before I ask for your comment, ultimately, my film was about me losing my home to foreclosure, literally losing my life, my business, everything, being on the downside of the economy after crushing it for so long. And you're going on a journey to the truth to find out everything you've been talking about for a long time. And it all became prologue to this super PAC to end all PACs because Americans aren't listening to Tom Hartman by the gazillions. The problem is they're not able to get their head around what it is that you do. There's got to be a way to connect with these people to understand that everything that is happening is destroying everybody except for the top 1%, just like what Pap was just talking about and making a change. And in that moment, you told me, well, what are you going to do? Ask people that are working two jobs apiece at Walmart and wherever else, you know, for donations? I mean, they can hardly survive anyway. And I felt dirty, as a matter of fact, after the conversation because I was so let down on myself because I've always enjoyed what you've
done. I'm sorry, Patrick, if I made you feel that.
But at the end of the day, Tom, you know, my question in terms of Lessig is, how are we going to reach the gazillions of people that need to get their heads out? Because they've got their heads in the sand, Tom.
Well, I didn't say that I'm opposed to what Larry Lessig is doing. I said that there's a rather emphatic debate been going on in the progressive community for some time. Actually, you know, the guy who got out ahead of this back in 2012 was who's James Carville's partner in crime? They were on Crossfire together. Paul Begala started a PAC and started a super PAC and started raising money. And he was going to use it both for the election of Obama and for other Democrats. And in fact, I ran into Paul Begala shortly after he started it at, I think it was the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This was like a couple of years ago, the one where Obama was making fun of Donald Trump. And Begala was taking a lot of flack for this originally. But then his PAC started running some really effective ads, and all of a sudden everybody shut up. And, you know, if Larry Lessig is able to use this money effectively, God bless him. I'm not opposed to this at all. And Patrick, when you were talking about doing it, I was just skeptical. I mean, Larry Lessig has a huge platform. He's been working for years and years and years on building a mailing list. He's had campaign after campaign where he asks people to sign petitions. And petitions are more often than not just ways to harvest email addresses. And so you build this huge mailing list, you know, if you got a couple million people now on your mailing list and they know about you because they've signed your petition for this, that, or the other thing, you can speak to them. And Larry Lessig has that. I mean, I don't know how many people he's got on his list, but he has been doing this for some time. And he's now, you know, enjoying some success apparently with this super PAC, and like I said, you know,
$1 million in 4 weeks.
Yeah, so if he can, you know, but see, $1 million is like the amount of money that the Koch brothers probably earn in 30 seconds.
That's right. You know, the one problem, Tom, is that his partner is Mark McKinnon, and he was a Karl Rove disciple.
Yeah, Mark McKinnon is Larry Lessig's partner.
Yeah, because, I mean, he was the Bush administration. So here's the problem. Yeah. Anyway, I made my point. I'm not going to try to – I'm so nice to – thank you for taking the call. But the bottom line is, from where I'm sitting, the middle class that has been, you know, just completely snuffed out, we got to be able to sell everyone on what's going on in thumbnails. That's the problem. Everybody's got the attention span of a gnat. Yeah. I spend time paying attention and studying and graduating from Tom Hartman University. I want to take that knowledge and go tell everybody else in thumbnails how it all works.
Yeah, and how can people find your movie right now, Patrick?
Oh, thank you, Tom. I appreciate it. It's forward13thefilm.com. And I think it's still playing on Free Speech TV, as a matter of fact. But we're going to do a national tour grassroots campaign, and I'd love to keep you on the loop on it because we've really connected the dots.
Yeah, please do that. When you do that, contact Sean, our producer, because she books all the guests onto the show. And you know, you've been on before. We'd love to have you back on. But you know, apropos of your starting a super PAC or Larry Lessig or anybody else on the left starting a super PAC, you know, we're all working to end super PACs. But if you guys can pull it off, God bless you. Good luck. And I hope Larry does, and I hope he's very, very successful. I'm just kind of baffled by it all. I didn't think it would work, and it apparently is. He's able to pull it off. We'll see. Patrick, thanks for the call. Good on you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, all that said, why did Bush and Cheney not show up at the 9/11 memorial today? It's the good, the bad, and the very, very heck, bornly ugly, the good. Chinese army? This month, the world's largest army made a truly revolutionary decision. It ordered all of its supply stations to stop purchasing GMO foods and oil. Its reasoning? Health and safety concerns. Imagine that. While countries all over the world have decided to strongly regulate GMOs or just say no to them altogether, we here in the United States have become guinea pigs in Monsanto's giant multi-generational experiment. Time for our government to start following China's lead and start cracking down on GMOs. The bad, Rafael Cruz, during a recent interview with the conservative watchdog group Media Research Center, the father of Ted Cruz praised that organization for sticking up to the liberal media and compared its work to the work of Jesus Christ. Check it out.
I am so, so happy to see what you guys are doing. You are doing something that is absolutely necessary in this country. When we have so much of the liberal media that they have ceased to be broadcasters, they have ceased to be really journalists, and they have become mouthpieces for the administration. They have apparently no concern for the truth. All they want to do is promote the talking points of the administration. So you are standing in the gap. You know, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free." And I think what you're doing is trying to bring that truth out.
That's right, folks. Rafael Cruz, Ted's dad, thinks that Jesus wants us all to fight the liberal media. Can you imagine what this guy would be like as first granddad? And very, very ugly, Bill O'Reilly. During yesterday's episode of The Factor, the Fox News host sat down with Reverend Jacques DeGaffe to debate the concept of white privilege. The segment pretty much went the way you'd expect it to go, with Bill totally rejecting the idea that white people have any sort of social advantage because of their race. Here's one of his more ridiculous arguments.
You believe that there is a white privilege component to America?
There has always, yes.
Okay, all right, let me stop you. Okay, now, I'm a really white guy. Mm-hmm. When I was in Hawaii last week, I couldn't go in the sun. If I was in the sun for 3 minutes, my ears would fall off, all right?
Yeah, O'Reilly actually made the argument because he gets sunburned, white privilege doesn't exist. He really doesn't get it, does he? And that's very, very ugly. That's actually astounding. You know, that's astounding. I'm kind of, it's the first time I've seen that clip, and it just kind of took my breath away. It's amazing. Scott in San Diego, California. Hey, Scott, what's on your mind?
Yes. First of all, it's hot. Let me tell you that.
It's hot in Southern California?
Yeah, and where I am, it's hot. No fires in my neighborhood, thank God, but
yeah.
Man, it is hot. No, I don't have air conditioning. I hope my rotary fan here is not making too much noise.
No, so you sound fine.
Okay. I'm intrigued with your idea to send for the righties to break away and start their own country comprised of the area known as West Texas. I even have a name for it. You could call it Puffy Shirtville or something like that.
Puffy Shirt.
their main credo is, you know, to be a true patriot, you must wear a puffy shirt, a tri-cornered hat, brandish either a flintlock or a assault weapon, and wave a "Don't Tread on Me" flag.
Right.
And as much as I'd like to see them all go down there, and if you've ever been to West Texas, you can roast there just as easily as you can.
I hitchhiked across West Texas when I was 17 years old, but that's the only one and only time in my life I've been in that part of the woods. I hitchhiked from San Antonio to San Francisco, and I had to go through West Texas to get there.
It does get hot there, too. But
the
only problem with your plan is, suppose they all go down there and start up their little country. Sooner or later, they're going to realize that they don't have anyone to yell at. It'll be like in the old animated cartoons where the cat and the dog are fighting, and they're going round and round, and there's dust and lightning bolts and planets and stars flying around. And one of them jumps out of the fray and stands there watching the other just, you know, moving about frantically.
Right.
Their whole code of living is having someone to yell about or to disagree with.
Oh, I think what they would do, Scott, is they would come up with these conspiracy theories that we were putting FEMA camps on their borders, and they would start developing tactical nuclear weapons to protect themselves, and we would find ourselves in a cold war with them.
You know? Oh, God.
I mean, doesn't it make sense? They were the people who drove the last Cold War. They're the people who are trying to create the next Cold War. So.
Well, it's an intriguing prospect.
Yeah.
But I'd rather have them around. They're fun to kick around and make fun of.
Well, and some of them are our neighbors and relatives, and I think we just have to learn how to get along with them. But still, it's interesting to speculate. Scott, thanks a lot for the very thoughtful call, and thanks for listening over at TomHartmann.com. Kevin in Durham, North Carolina, watching us on the Dish Satellite Network on Free Speech TV channel. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wish to talk about so many people are talking about Benghazi, and I just wish they would give the same attention to investigating 9/11.
Yeah.
You've talked about and mentioned the August 6th presidential daily briefing that was given to George Bush in Crawford, Texas.
Yep.
And many other countries gave intelligence a forewarning. But what needs more discussion is how they handled it. And instead of being on the highest alert, they had the police of the sky, the Air Force, holding war games and hijacking exercises.
Yeah.
And this is all a matter,
which was very confusing,
of public record. Cynthia McKinney had a hearing with General Myers and Donald Rumsfeld, and the documentary Loose Change, the final cut, has that footage. And so anybody can go and verify that these war games and exercises were happening.
Right.
And many fighters were moved away from D.C. and the New York area. And even in the 9/11 Commission report video, they had transmission between FAA and NORAD. And NORAD had to ask, is this the real thing?
Right.
And standard operating procedures were not followed. Fighter pilots usually up in the sky within 12 minutes of a plane being off course over 2 miles and, transmission not being recorded between the two.
Right.
And 67 times between January of 2001 and 9/11, they were up there in that average time without a hitch. But that day, there were no fighter pilots along any of those planes.
Well, there is one theory that Flight 93 was actually shot down at Dick Cheney's order, but, it's not. I think that that's one of those things that is actually, a credible conspiracy theory or whatever you want to call it, and the administration wouldn't want to cop to it because it's like, we just killed a bunch of civilians because that plane was probably headed for the White House.
Right. But why weren't there aircraft up in the sky? I mean, and two, just for the sake that the Air Force, actually NORAD had to ask, is this the real thing? You would think with all the forewarnings, they would have been on the highest alert. And, it just does not make sense.
Yeah. Well, it only makes sense. Now, here's where this is very, very thin ice. In 1998, the Project for a New American Century, a document signed off on by Paul Wolfowitz and Jeb Bush and the whole neocon crowd, but a whole bunch of prominent Republicans who later were very, very tightly associated with or even part of the Bush administration, talked about how we needed to invade Iraq. It was an open letter to Bill Clinton, please invade Iraq, and to establish a giant footprint in the Middle East, and also because Iraq had the second largest supply of easily available oil in the world, and it was largely virgin and therefore very cheap. And, please do this. And they mentioned, on the Project for New American Century's website, that it would probably take a Pearl Harbor-like event to convince the American people that an invasion of Iraq was a worthwhile endeavor. And so when Bush was warned repeatedly, I mean, Sandy Berger came on this program and told me and all of our listeners, and there's archives of it out there on the Internet someplace, Sandy Berger came on this program and said when he made the, you know, when in 2001, when they handed the White House off, you know, handed the keys to the White House over to the Bush administration, he told Condoleezza Rice, and he had personal knowledge, that Al Gore told Dick Cheney and that Bill Clinton told George W. Bush, your number one priority has to be Osama bin Laden. I know you made fun of us when we tried to throw those three missiles into his camp to kill him, and we missed him by 30 minutes back during the impeachment hearings. You thought we were trying to change the subject, but he really has to be your number one thing because he is planning to attack the United States, and he has said so, and he's credible. And Sandy Berger came on this program and said that, and they tried to shut him up with this whole thing about he stuffed a piece of paper in his pants or something. I mean, you know, they really tried to discredit him. And I think that, you know, they knew something was going to happen, and they basically, I don't want to say stand down, they just didn't amp up the way they should have, thinking that it was probably going to be something like the Blind Sheikh did, you know, a bomb in downtown Manhattan, something like that. I think that this was way worse than they expected. And I think that's why George Bush sat there for 7 minutes, chewing the inside of his cheek, stunned, because it was way worse than what he expected. But, you know, that's a conspiracy theory of one. Kevin, thanks for the call. And I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't show up at the 9/11 Memorial.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Now, I realize there are far more elaborate conspiracy theories out there, and this is just really not even a conspiracy theory. It's more of just kind of, hey, look at what happened. Anyway, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Karen in Powell, Tennessee, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite. Hey, Karen, what's up? Karen? You are on the air. You gotta listen to your phone. There you are.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am. Sorry, sir.
You're quite all right. You're on the air. What's up?
I was just listening to all of this, and the Clintons had to have known about the Kittel and Bush because they bombed the coal and everything else. So
Yeah.
I agree with you on that.
No, and Al Gore's on the record, and Bill Clinton's on the record as having said that they told their respective, you know, George Bush and Dick Cheney to look out for bin Laden. They haven't gone so far as to say then they ignored it, but the reality is that Cheney and Bush basically, and Condi Rice basically said, anything Bill Clinton was worried about, we're not going to worry about because Bill Clinton was wrong about everything. So
that's just crazy.
Yeah, it is.
But that's not what I was wondering about the MOOCs. I love your show, and I'm just saying, but anyway, I was wondering what you thought about if the universities could actually get MOOCs and try those out for education.
These MOOCs are these online classes where you've got an instructor who's in front of a classroom, but it's been simultaneously beamed all over the world on the internet, or even sometimes archived, and people can watch it later. And people can watch these and sign up and for or without credit. They were a big hot thing back a year or so ago. They were going to be the savior of higher education, the reinvention. They were going to help educate all these long-term unemployed people in new job skills, you know, bring people into the university systems and things. And if you look at the statistics, and there's been some really interesting reporting on this, Karen, done in the last 6 months or so. There's a piece in the New York Times. There's a piece in Harper's, as I recall. I think there was a piece in Slate. It turns out that they have a graduation rate of like 2 or 3%. I mean, it's like really, really low. Most people don't stay with them. Most people don't even watch the entire segment, much less stay with the whole course. There's something fundamentally different from being in a room with another human being and other human beings around you from watching a TV screen. And that difference makes it much harder to learn from watching the TV screen, unless it's in a very entertainment format, you know, like 60 Minutes or Years of Living Dangerously, you know, these kind of high production value things.
I guess I must be one of the weird ones that actually like it, because I'm.
You're that 1% or that 3%. Yeah.
Yes. I wasn't taking classes online as is now, but it's so expensive. I'm so scared of loans.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take out loans. And so, and I don't know how to drive. I live in Powell, which has no bus lines. I mean, no bus lines at all. It stops. Knoxville, I'm in between Knoxville and Oak Ridge. I don't know if you know Tennessee very well.
Vaguely.
But.
Yeah.
But I'm in between Knoxville and Oak Ridge. And the buses stop on. At the border of Powell, which everybody thinks Powell is Knoxville, but they would stop at the border.
Mm-hmm.
They do not go all the way out to the line, county line.
Right.
Yes. And this the only, this
so you don't have a way to get to a college other than doing it online, in other words. That's your point.
Exactly.
Yeah. And Karen, I suspect that there's a lot of people in America in the same boat. And the question is, did the MOOCs fail because they were badly executed? Or because it was a bad idea, or what? And I'm not sure anybody knows the answer to that. Thanks for the call, and thanks for raising the issue, though. Appreciate it. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, where you can give a goat to help save the life of not just a returning slave, but their entire family. Through goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org as well. Let's get Don Siegelman on the act. Hey, Ellen, what's up?
Well, you know, we really want to help Governor Siegelman. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, Nancy Pelosi issued a statement. The Oversight and Government Reform Committee of Daryl Issa had its own subpoena to Secretary of State John Kerry today, and said that, she said, Chairman Issa's subpoena of Secretary Kerry calls into question the Republican stated purpose of the Select Committee. It's a sign of no confidence in Issa, just as Issa's action today is a sign of lack of confidence in the Select Committee.
Oh, in other words, she's pointing out that there are now competing Benghazi committees on
right.
the Republican side.
Then what happens is U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, he's a Republican from South Carolina, we all know Lindsey Graham,
yeah.
he released a letter signed by 37 senators, and they want to press for Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid to establish a select committee to investigate Benghazi. they're saying the American people, and especially the families of the fallen, deserve to know more. So now you would have essentially three committees on this.
Actually, one of these three families has officially come out and said, please, no more committees. And another one of the family members has said, please don't politicize this. And the other two, to the best of my knowledge, have just been silent on this. I don't think any of these families are calling for this kind of stuff, unless I'm mistaken. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Pretty astounding, honestly.
Yeah, it really is. What it's all about is that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she might run for president. That's what this is all about.
Right. Well, exactly, and they just want to stop her in her tracks, just like Karl Rove issued that insane statement this week.
Yes, and by the way, the rumor going around the internet that Karl Rove has a 2-inch penis, no truth to it.
I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, there's actually a graphic, and it's gone viral on Facebook that has a picture of him and Don at the bottom. It's, you know, it asks that it basically asks that question. It says it's probably not true, you know. And it's like, you know, it's doing what he's doing, right? It's start nasty rumors. Only it does it in a kind of a funny way, because I don't think anybody actually thinks that. But, you know, anyway, back to you.
Okay. Then today, this afternoon, as the House is out of session, there is a campaign spending amendment, and this was the 2010 Supreme Court decision that, of course, has unlimited amount of spending. And Harry Reid said the Supreme Court has equated money with speech, so the more money you have, the more speech you get. And he said that's wrong. They said they want to do their own amendment. Senator Tom Udall, Michael Bennett of Colorado have their own amendment, and it would be a constitutional amendment would stop, basically, as they say, would not give corporations a vote.
Hmm. Interesting.
And so he said, Harry Reid said, let's keep our elections from becoming speculative ventures for the wealthy.
They're good on him.
Okay, now, the next big issue today is the open internet and the FCC. Now, Why the president did not come out with this before today, I don't know. But the president, the White House issued this statement today, basically saying the president has made clear since he was a candidate that he supports net neutrality and an open internet. As he has said, the internet's incredible equality of data, content, access to the consumer is what has powered the extraordinary economic growth and made it possible for once tiny sites like eBay or Amazon to compete with brick and mortar. Now, they said that the FCC is an independent agency, and we will carefully review their proposal.
So he is not, the White House is not calling for common carrier status either. They're simply putting out some nice words.
That's right, and we don't know what they're doing. Now, there is a sort of independent group called NoSlowLanes.com, and they said today's vote created two possible paths for the Internet, and one is for fast lines for big corporations, as you would call banksters. And by the way, I saw somebody referring to banksters, and they didn't quote you. It made me mad.
Oh, bless you.
It made me mad. They didn't quote Dr. Tom. The second, they said, which opened only as a result of massive public outrage over the first, would reclassify the Internet as a public utility like water, equally accessible to all.
Yeah, and that's really what needs to be done, and that's what the U.S. Circuit Court suggested. And I was astounded. The New York Times had a front-page article about this, and they buried that in the third from the last paragraph, that fact that, you know, the easy solution to all this is for the FCC to simply use Title II and say the Internet is just like the phone companies. They're common carriers. And the people who are carrying the messages over the Internet cannot, just like a phone company, can't listen in on your conversation and then charge you based on who you're talking to and what you say. The Internet can't charge based on what the content is, what, you know, what's going through it. They can charge based on how many bits of data you buy, just like you can charge based on how many minutes you're on the phone. But that's it. You know, it's neutral with regard to content. And it's a simple thing. It could be done with a single sentence, but anyway, I'm blithering here.
Yes.
Back to you.
Well, you're not, but no, you're absolutely correct. And again, it's not, I mean, other than, well, it's not totally slow news days. There's a lot going on in the rest of the world. But the other thing is, the president today was at the 9/11 memorial.
Why was Bush and Cheney not there?
$4.
Pardon?
They're charging $24 to get into the museum.
Well, that's not good.
It's not good at all.
Why were Bush and Cheney not at the opening ceremony?
I have no idea. They might not have even been invited. It's just staggering.
I can't believe they weren't invited. I think that they didn't go because they feel like they have so much blood on their hands around this thing. They were warned over and over and over again this thing was coming, and they didn't do anything to stop it.
You know, maybe Cheney wouldn't have gone for that reason. That would not have stopped President Bush.
You think not? Huh.
Absolutely not.
I still think he's doing his paintings of himself in the shower because he's trying to wash the blood off his hands. It's Lady Macbeth all over again. You know?
That would be interesting.
Yeah, but I could be wrong. So much for psychoanalysis. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Ready News Service, talkreadynews.com, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, free-don.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, one of the, you know, the this minimum wage, the $15 thing for fast food workers, the President Obama suggesting $10.10 an hour as a minimum wage. It would take 3 years to get there, but which is typically how minimum wage increases are done. From 69 to 71, we raised the minimum wage 28% over 3 years. This would be a 39% increase, by the way, that's being proposed by the administration right now. From 74 to 76, we raised the minimum wage 43.8%. From 78 to 81, we raised it 45%. And from 2007 to 2009, we raised it 40%. Each time, that was over 3 years, except for the 78 to 81. That was over a four-year period. And throughout all of them, Walmart did really well, as did the economy. But Michael Saltzman begs to defer. He is the research director for the Employment Policies Institute, the website epionline.org. Michael wrote an op-ed that got posted in the Washington Post, in fact. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, it's good to be here, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. First of all, you know, I read your report filled with incredible math and formulas and all, you know, really fancy. I mean, you know, it's I realize that, you know, you guys are really Berman and Company, a PR firm, and it's clear that it's really well done. But I didn't see anything about history. I mean, we've been raising the minimum wage since it was created in 1935, and every time we raise the minimum wage, the economy does better. We've never, ever seen a documented job loss in this. Washington State, that has the highest minimum wage in the United States, also has the strongest economy in the United States. When I was living in Portland and we raised the minimum wage for restaurant workers, the restaurant industry was going, oh my God, it's going to be a disaster, you know, going from $2 to $9 or $10. And no, actually, all the restaurants all did better over the following years. I don't get it.
Well, I think you don't get it because what you just described there is not consistent with what we've actually seen in the evidence. I mean, I could be happy to send you, you know, a couple dozen anecdotes from newspapers, if that's what you'd like, of business owners that actually have had to cut back. But I think the more important thing.
Well, no, wait a minute. Wait a second. If you've got a business owner who has to cut back, you've got a business owner with a lousy business model.
Yeah, let's return to that in just a minute. But the more important thing is that economists actually have been studying this issue. You know, economists have been studying it since the late 1940s, but they've been studying it even more in the last 20 years. And what we've seen through labor market data from the federal government and empirical studies and published in peer-reviewed journals is that when you raise the minimum wage, no, it doesn't crater the economy. And economists aren't saying it will crater the economy, but what it does is it does reduce employment and it reduces jobs for people at the bottom rungs of the career ladder. And particularly right now in an environment.
No, it doesn't.
It absolutely does. I mean, you can refuse to.
Please name one year. We've had a minimum wage since 1935. 1 year when we raised the minimum wage and in the following year we saw employment fall.
We saw teen employment fall. Well, we've seen that in a number of instances. I mean, I could
1 year
85%. I could point to any number of years that minimum wage increases.
Pick one.
Both in between 2007 and 2009, 114,000 fewer teens had jobs because
Of course, because of the Great Bush Depression.
114,000, and that's in a study that controlled for the impact of the recession.
Oh, come on.
85% of the best studies over the last 20 years. 85%. Point to lost jobs following a minimum.
You mean 85% of the studies that have been paid for by business groups that are published on the internet?
That's not true. No, that's according to a survey of all those studies from economists at the Federal Reserve and the University of California, Irvine.
You know, the Economic Policy Institute.
It's better to sort of be rhetorical about it and claim that no jobs have been lost, but that's not what the evidence says. It's just it's plain not what it says.
You guys are the Economic Policy. Excuse me, Economic Employment Institute.
The Employment Policy.
EPIOnline.org. That's your organization.
Yeah, and minimumwage.com, too, is right. You can find some of our stuff.
And which is operating out of the same offices as, you know, Rick Berman's PR firm, and who came out of the restaurant industry at Steak and Ale and used to be a PR flack for the tobacco industry, the alcohol industry. In fact, 60 Minutes did a piece on your boss calling him Dr. Evil. It's like And I'm astounded that I wanted to point this out because I'm astounded that the Washington Post didn't.
Your argument is on the minimum wage.
The point that I wanted to make is that the actual EPI, the Real Economic Policy Institute, which has 20 employees, 20 staff, and 36 respected scholars, published a long and detailed study on the impact of raising the minimum wage.
Yeah,
and
what academic journal was that one published in? Because all the studies I just referenced for you were published in academic journals. Which one was the Economic Policy Institute published in?
I don't know.
Maybe the FLCIO published it in their newsletter. I mean, they might have done that.
So, again, you can't name a year other than the Bush crash year.
No, in 96 and 97, it happened too. It happened in the early 1990s when it went up under Bush. It happened during those ones
employment.
During the Carter years. What we have seen consistently is every single time the minimum wage goes up, is employment for young adults has fallen, and it's very clear in the data.
If somebody's business model is that the only way that they can run their business is to pay people so poorly that those people can't live, and I know you're trying to turn this into the thing about teenagers, but the average age of an employee in the fast food industry right now is 29. It's not, the whole old entry job thing. That was back before Reaganomics. That was back when we had an actual economy.
Half of the people who are in the minimum wage are still between the age of 16 and 24. One quarter are between 16 and 19. So there is still very much a large counterpart or part of this group that is young.
Right. And my point is that if your business model requires the exploitation of that kind of labor, you should not be doing business in the United States of America. This is the richest country in the world.
We should simply lose their jobs as the minimum wage goes up to 10-10. I mean, that's cold comfort.
Nobody is using those kind of numbers. I mean, even the Congressional Budget Office said it could be a positive effect, it could be zero, or it could be as many as 500,000 people could lose their jobs.
As many as 1 million people. 500,000 is their central estimate.
And if that happens, and the economy is stronger as a consequence of it, and those marginal businesses. I mean, do you really think that McDonald's has fat in their labor force?
I think that this is ultimately...
They have fat in their CEO force.
I think this is ultimately an issue that comes back to the customer. And I hear a lot about CEO pay, and I'll tell you, we did the math on it. And if you took the pay of a McDonald's CEO and his bonuses, and you cut it to zero, and you divided it among all the employees, you could give everyone about a penny an hour raise.
Well, why do that? Why not take the CEO, all the senior executives, and all the dividends?
Because at the end of the
day, if you did that, what would that?
Customer. It comes back to the customer.
No, it doesn't.
No, it absolutely.
It goes to the stockholder.
Because if customers were willing to pay higher prices, there would never be a debate about the minimum wage. You could raise it to whatever you wanted. You could do what Barbara Lee wants to do and raise it to $26 an hour.
No, because what has happened is we've got this new business model, Michael. We have a new business model where these companies are expecting you and me to subsidize them. They're paying just enough that their employees are eligible for food stamps and other welfare programs. And we are subsidizing Walmart workers. We are subsidizing minimum wage workers. And I would think as a conservative that you would find that outrageous.
Tom, I'll tell you what. Let me what I find outrageous. The idea that we could be providing a 100% subsidy for a number of these workers if we raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour and the job they used to do.
That's no subsidy at all. Then they get off the government dole.
No, that's a 100% subsidy.
They're no longer eligible for any government programs.
And they don't have a job. The reason we have programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit, it's because Bill Clinton, of all people, said we have programs like the Earned Income Tax Credit because it is more effectively than a higher minimum wage can raise people out of poverty. We do that to maintain the opportunities that they have.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll leave it at that. I'll leave you with the last word. Michael Saltzman, the website epionline.org. Research Director of the Employment Policies Institute.
Hey,
thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Good talking to you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Pretty good for a PR flack, pretending to be an economist. Be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Roberto, listening on KBCS in Enumclaw, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong, Washington. Hey, Roberto, how do you say your tone?
It's Enumclaw.
Enumclaw. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Native American.
I was going to make a comment on Bill O'Reilly's ridiculous comic. He mentioned going to Hawaii so nonchalant as if anybody and everybody can afford to go to Hawaii.
Right.
So in the same breath that he's denying white privilege, he's actually proving it.
That's a good point. He's also proving the privilege of just being a host on a major network station where you make, I don't know what he's making, but I'd be surprised if he's making less than $5 million a year. Over at Fox, and along with that kind of income comes a whole lot of privilege too, regardless of your race.
I
think that what I think is more astounding was, he says to this guy, so you think there's white privilege, and the guy starts to say yes, and here's why, and O'Reilly says, oh, wait, I gotta tell you, I can get a sunburn, I'm not privileged.
Yeah.
My head is exploding. Anyhow, thanks for the call, Roberto. Gabby in Eugene, Oregon, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. What's up, Gabby?
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
First of all, I want to say I've been a real fan of yours for many years. I started reading your books on ADHD when I had a son that was diagnosed with that.
Oh, great.
And I'm in Eugene, Oregon, so you can imagine that we have a lot of things here in Eugene that in common with what you say about a lot of the things you've been talking about.
Yeah.
But I just want to go into one thing about health care.
Mm-hmm.
And in line with the young man who was trying to tell us that we don't really need a higher minimum wage, Oregon had a cobbled together plan called Cover Oregon to enroll people in the National Healthcare Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. What happened in Oregon was pretty sad because we were a state that, for the most part, there were a lot of people behind the idea of it. What happened in Oregon is $181 million went to Cover Oregon and to some technology companies who failed miserably to get people enrolled. But they did get a lot of people enrolled. Estimated in Lane County, about 140,000 people that were enrolled are in Medicaid. In other words, they're low income. They're the people who don't make enough money to even pay in to the Affordable Care Act through private insurance.
Right.
So what's happened, and I'm a mental health care worker in a small agency that's been a nonprofit here in Eugene. We have seen Trillium, which is our local manager for the what used to be the Oregon Health Plan, which is Medicaid. First of all, they have cut all of the indigent beds. In other words, if you don't have that insurance, you cannot get this particular crisis respite program. If you're out on the street, you can't get in the hospital, you feel suicidal, homicidal, whatever. You can't get a bed at our facility anymore because Trillium now pretty much runs the show. Now, I'm not going to go into Trillium, but I will say I'm hearing people come in, and they're reporting that they got the insurance months ago. They still cannot find a primary care physician that will take them.
It's going to take time to catch up, Gavin. It's going to take time. And I think the two things that we're going to see, number one, the AMA needs to stop limiting the number of people who can graduate from medical schools. And number two, we need to expand what physician assistants and RNs and nurse practitioners can do. I think that'll happen. Gabby, thanks for the call. As more money is available, I think these things will grow. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour, and Libby in Washington State with WAMEND.org. Libby, you got 30 seconds to plug what's up.
Oh, hey, Tom, thanks so much. I just wanted to mention that we have a new business for democracy. A chiropractor from Auburn just came by our office and picked up a box in which we have petitions, and people in public places can sign the petition and various businesses.
Right.
They should go to WAMEND.org and find out where they can go to a business that's close by and sign it, as well as hit that donate button and support our cause here in the state of Washington.
To get a constitutional amendment to basically say corporations aren't people and money is not speech passed on the ballot, as a ballot initiative on the ballot in Washington State. Libby, great. Great job. Thank you very much for the call. Daniel in Skokie, Illinois. Hey, Daniel, what's up?
Hi, how are you?
I'm
glad
well.
To talk to you.
Thank you.
I got a couple of questions.
Mm-hmm.
Basically the same thing. The Supreme Court decision on corporations being people, is this actually interpreted as people, or was this something the politicians were saying?
No, it's an oversimplification. in historically, I mean, back even before America was America, there's always been what's called personhood status for institutions other than human beings. Human beings are referred to as natural persons. Churches, governments, and corporations are referred to, and unions are referred to as what's called artificial corporations. And natural persons have rights under the Constitution. Artificial persons have no rights under the Constitution, historically. In 1886, the railroads argued in Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad before the U.S. Supreme Court that the 14th Amendment, which says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, does not say no natural person, and therefore it meant corporations as well as humans. The court basically laughed at that concept, did not include any mention of that in its ruling, but in the headnote of the ruling, which was written by the clerk of the court after the Chief Justice was dead of congestive heart failure 2 years later, in the headnote it says, actually, yeah, corporations are persons. And I think what they meant was artificial persons, obviously. But what has happened over the last 30 years, and it started with the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 76, it's followed by Boston versus Bilotti in 77, and then came to a screaming culmination with Citizens United in 2010, is the idea that under many circumstances, corporations actually do have equal protection rights under the 14th Amendment. And not just equal protection with regard to this corporation has to have the same legal protections as that corporation, but that this corporation has the same legal protections as that human being. And this is a perversion of the 14th Amendment, in my mind.
And that's what I'm thinking. And the reason I'm asking this question is because I believe we fought a civil war so persons couldn't own persons.
That's correct. In fact, it's made illegal on the 13th.
If a corporation wants to buy a corporation, it would be a person buying a corporation or owning a corporate person, would it not?
It would. It would. And the Supreme Court, I mean, it's the same thing with the free speech. The way that they worded this, and I encourage you to read the Citizens United decision. Actually, I encourage you to read the dissent first, because then reading the decision makes a lot more sense. And the dissent is only 30, 40 pages long. It's brilliantly written, and it's very easy to read. John Paul Stevens wrote it, the principal dissent, and it's really, really well done. And what the court did with speech, for example, is they said that we natural persons have a right to be as well informed as possible. That's included in the protection of press and free speech in the First Amendment. And the principal actors in our society who have access to the information that we need to be well-informed are corporations, the news corporations, the media corporations, or if it's information about pesticides, Monsanto. If it's information about telecom, it would be Verizon or AT&T. And because those corporations have that information, and we have a right to know the information, it's not that they have a right to speak, it's that we have a right to hear what they say. And so we can't limit what they say, because by doing so, we would limit the right of humans to hear information coming from the principal actors in the political and business milieu. And so it's a bizarre kind of double reverse backflip logic that the Supreme Court uses to both establish corporate personhood and to establish that speech is, that money is somehow the same thing as speech.
Again, and I don't mean to interrupt you,
feel free.
Couldn't this backward logic be used to be said that Comcast can't buy another cable company?
No, unfortunately it can't, because they did use that double twist backflip. They didn't just, if they had simply come out and said, a corporation is a person under the 14th Amendment, we're not distinguishing between natural persons and artificial persons, and they have full rights under all the other parts of the Constitution. Corporations, therefore, have Fifth Amendment rights, and those have been asserted, by the way, and against taking, you know, and eminent domain and things like that, but that they have Sixth, Seventh, Eighth Amendment rights. Those have been asserted for corporations, the right to a fair trial. But if they were to say that corporations have all the same rights and privileges as human beings, it would open a huge can of worms. You know, marriage is polygamy, you know, if three corporations merge, are we violating bigamy laws? You know, what's the gender of corporations? Is it illegal for them to merge in some states and not in others? You know, all this stuff. So therefore, they didn't do it that way. They did it with this little, you know, soft shoe song and dance. So, and like I said, you can. First of all, I wrote an entire book about this called Unequal Protection, which lays all this stuff out from the very early, you know, from the founding of the country up until today. But secondly, the book is available for free online over at truthout.org. You can read the entire book online. So I'm not just trying to plug the book. I think it's so, you know, such important information. I gave it away. But also, I encourage you to just read The Dissent in Citizens United. It's online all over the place. Easy to find. Thanks, Daniel.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And John Paul Stevens himself has a new book out in which he is proposing a constitutional amendment, which Udall now is pushing in the Senate to undo part of Citizens United. Stop the greedy clown. Yeah, this is a McDonald's. they're rolling out their clown again. It would be interesting. I remember, I've told this story so many times. I apologize to those of you who listen all the time. But years ago, maybe 5 years ago, Louise and I lived in Portland, and there was a neighborhood called Selwood, which was right across the Willamette River from where we lived. And we would just walk over the bridge there, the Selwood Bridge, and I think it was called, and into Selwood and go for, you know, to the local store to grocery shopping. And there were some nice restaurants over there. And Selwood and Walmart wanted to put a store in there, and the local community was fighting back. And there was all these houses all along the road had these signs in the windows that said no Walmart, and, you know, Walmart with a red X through it and all that kind of stuff. And Louise and I are walking over there one day, and there's this guy standing out on the street, and he's got this big sign that says Selwood Loves Walmart. And he's standing there on the sidewalk, you know, in the busiest street, the one that goes over the bridge. And people are going by and honking or whatever. So I walked up to him, and I said, how much is Walmart paying you to hold that sign? And he said, $15 an hour. And I said, hey, that's pretty good. And he says, yeah, I think I make more than most Walmart people do. And so, you know, we just kept on going, and I told the story on the air the next day, and I don't know, I hope he didn't lose his job, but whatever. So now there's this campaign called Stop the Greedy Clown. New video slams Ronald McDonald on the eve of an international strike. There is this strike all across the United States right now, or all over the world, 230 cities on 33 countries in six continents. Six continents? Is Antarctica the seventh? I thought it was the sixth. Okay, what are the six continents? South America, North America, Australia, Africa, Asia, Europe. I already said Australia. Okay, South America, North America, Europe, Asia, Africa, Australia, and Antarctica. That's seven. Oh, yeah, okay. So it's on six continents. All right. Sometimes, you know, you just got to count on your fingers. Anyway, what I'm wondering is how much do they pay the clown guys? I think this would be a fascinating thing to find out. Do they pay the clown guys to go out and say, hey, I'm the clown, I'm Ronald McDonald? Do they pay them more than they pay the people who actually make the food, who do the work, who get the burns and the hot grease? I bet they do. Anyhow, Patrick in St. Charles, Illinois, it says you disagree with me. So you go to the top of the line. What's up? What are you disagreeing about?
Good afternoon. Disagreement, not so much as, well, yes, disagreement, Tom, but I'm talking about your statement that Bush is spending, evidently President Bush, hours a day in a shower or bath washing the...
No, I didn't say that. I said he's painted two paintings of himself, two self-portraits, one in the shower and one in the bathtub.
I've seen them, yes.
Yeah, and I was saying that I think he's doing...
Go ahead.
Well, I was saying I think that those were his only self-portraits. There were no self-portraits of him walking through fields or sitting in a chair or anything else. I think he's, at some deep level concerned about washing the blood off his hands.
No, you've said this on a number of occasions.
Yes, I'm consistent.
Let's say I were to agree with you, which I totally disagree, but
okay.
In the gallery of those that would be washing blood from hands, you have two of your most favorite that would be way, way ahead of Bush, starting with FDR and the debacle of course, Pearl Harbor, when there's a substantial historic study that he knew that was coming well in advance. And then secondly...
So you are of the opinion that we should not have gotten into World War II?
No, I'm of the opinion he needed, and we know this from fact, he needed the American people to rally behind him so he could go to war. FDR wanted to go to war. He wanted to assist Churchill in the Eastern theater, and he had concerns of the Japanese.
Right.
And there is a large body of work, historic body of work, that supports the notion that he knew that Pearl Harbor was going to be attacked.
Yeah, there's also a fair number of scholars who suggest that they simply lost track of the Northern Fleet, and
that may remain.
But whether or not, you know, I would not equate FDR, even if FDR, forget about whether he knew Pearl Harbor was going to happen. He provoked Pearl Harbor by cutting off the oil supply at the Straits of Malacca. When he barricaded the Straits of Malacca so that the Japanese could no longer import oil from the Middle East, he provoked a response, whether it was in Pearl Harbor or anywhere else. I think he knew that he was going to provoke a response. So I'll give you that. But that said, I don't think that FDR fighting World War II, regardless of the provocation that was used to get us into it, I don't think that you can equate that with George Bush going into Iraq.
Well, from a numbers standpoint, a much different situation.
I'm talking about the morality of it. There was no reason for us to go into Iraq, and we've left that country far worse than when we found it. And there was a very good reason for us to go into Europe, and we left Europe in better shape than when we damaged it pretty bad.
FDR was a piker. John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Baines Johnson are the Stalinists of the history of this country.
Are you talking about Vietnam?
Leading a nation. I happen to be one of them. 58,000 Americans killed, another 500,000 wounded, and 2 million Vietnamese died in that war.
Yeah, I'll give you that, although I would not include Kennedy in that. Johnson made the decision to escalate that.
He kicked it off.
Kennedy put the advisors in there, yes. But it was Johnson who turned it into a war with the phony Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and he deserves to be condemned for that. And it was Richard Nixon who extended it in 1968, after LBJ had negotiated peace with the Vietnamese. It was Richard Nixon who extended that, and at that point there was only about 20,000 dead Americans. It was Richard Nixon who, in 1968, who went to the Vietnamese, the South Vietnamese, and said, "Do not go along with this peace deal that LBJ has worked out with you."
LBJ quit. He quit as president. "I will not accept, nor will I run." He quit as a commander in chief.
Now, his party told him to.
And another million men were over there bleeding.
But Patrick, listen to this. Listen to this. In 1968, LBJ knew that his brand was so tarnished there was no way he could run for re-election because of Vietnam. And he felt horrible about Vietnam. In fact, I've got a clip of I'm going to find this clip. I don't think Shane has this absolutely incredible clip of LBJ. My computer's taking forever. I'll find this while we're playing this. This is LBJ had negotiated peace between North and South Vietnam in August of 1968. And I don't know when you were in Vietnam, but if it was after 68.
I was in from 67 to 71.
Okay, then you were there after 68. You need to hear this tape. He had negotiated peace. It was going to be announced in September, which, of course, would ensure that Hubert Humphrey would win the election, Humphrey versus Nixon. Nixon's people found out about this, and his campaign manager, who was operating out of New Mexico, contacted Madam Tu in the Vietnamese embassy and said, don't go to Paris. Don't go along with the peace talks. We will make you personally multimillionaires, and we'll give you a better deal. Lyndon Johnson heard the tapes of this that were brought to him by the CIA, and he called up the senior Republican in the U.S. Senate, Everett Dirksen, one of the most high-integrity people in the history in my lifetime in politics, Republican. Called up Everett Dirksen and had this conversation with him on the telephone. This was just released by the LBJ Library 3 years ago, and I don't know why it wasn't on the front page of the Wall Street Journal and the front in the New York Times. Listen to this.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
So I would add Richard Nixon to your list.
Richard Nixon, and more specifically, Henry Kissinger, ended that war.
Jerry Ford ended the war.
Who?
Jerry Ford. Jerry Ford was president when the war ended.
Well, he was president when the war ended, but Jerry Ford got rid of
Nixon extended the war.
End the war.
He extended the war because he blew up the peace negotiations.
Ended that war. And you know that, Tom, and I know that.
I bet.
I mean, from a standpoint of negotiating and from a standpoint of meeting with the principals, yeah. Henry Kissinger is responsible for it finally being... I won't say resolved. It wasn't resolved.
Yeah.
But stopped.
Okay. Hang on. I can't put you on hold, but I'm actually I am gonna put you on hold, Patrick. Just so you can hear this. I'm gonna play a clip here. Actually, I'll do it when I come back from the break, from the national break. Patrick, thanks for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
More in just a moment. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Pat, listening on WBAI in Levittown, New York. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Long-time listener. And I really enjoy listening to your show. I learn a lot from you.
Thank you.
I just want to touch back on, you had a conversation. I was in my car at the time, and I had to break off to go come in my house. You and a gentleman were talking about corporations and people.
Right.
Okay, so I just want to say two things. according to algebra, you have to equal both sides of the equation.
Right.
So if corporations are people, then people are corporations and should get the same benefits that corporations do. Plus, if money is speech, then I should be able to talk to my creditors and pay my bills that way. The second thing is that Mitt Romney, if corporations are people, then Mitt Romney and his company, his corporation, should be brought up on murder charges for killing businesses and factories and that they take over.
Yep, yep. Or bigamy and polygamy charges for merging them when they do. Yeah, I'm with you,
right.
Pat. And this does is it illustrates the absurdity of the whole doctrine that the Supreme Court has tried to shove down our throats. Pat, thanks for listening to WBAI. Ron, you're watching Free Speech TV in Clearfield, Tennessee. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I was listening to that fella just talking about the minimum wage.
Yeah.
And I guess it's good that he's concerned about minimum wage workers, but I believe if I was living on minimum wage, I'd take my chances on a raise.
What do you mean?
Well, I'd rather have the minimum wage raised up instead of trying to survive on what it is now.
On $7 an hour, seven and change. Yeah, I'm with you, and I think most people working at the minimum wage feel the same way. And you know, yeah, there may be a few fewer jobs, although frankly, I think there'll be more jobs. Because there'll be more money circulating in the economy, which means there'll be more demand. So they raise the minimum wage, it stimulates the economy. There's this thing called the multiplier effect. But, you know, these conservative economists, well, this guy isn't even an economist. He works for a PR firm. Are pitching these ideas, and they're just pitching it because they represent companies whose business model is to basically, you know, pay their workers just enough that they are just under the amount where they will qualify for, where they will qualify for food stamps and things like that. And so we end up subsidizing them. So anyhow, Ron, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Tony in Terre Haute, Indiana. Tony, got a minute to the break. It's yours.
Okay, I'll try to do this real quick. You said about a week ago or so you were going to talk about an author who wrote a book about the mini revolution of 1800.
Yes, sir. And that is available over at Amazon right now. If you look at Revolution of 1800 and put my name in, you will find the book. You can pre-order it.
Perfect. My question, Tom. Okay, all the stars seem to be aligned to not be living in a Hamiltonian America. You had 24 years of Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, the tragic death of Hamilton, one term of John Adams, who went into retirement when he was beat by Jefferson. What happened?
What happened back then?
No. All the stars were aligned to not have a Hamiltonian America, based on what I just said.
Oh yeah, there's a cliche, and in fact, I quoted in the introduction to this new book that we all talk about Jefferson, but we live in Hamilton's America. And I think what happened in large part was the cancer of slavery ate away at America, and then the Industrial Revolution came along, and that made Hamilton's America inevitable. Because Jefferson was a pastoralist. He thought everybody, we should all be about farming. And at a certain level that, you could argue that when the steam engine and the cotton gin came along, slavery could have ended, but it didn't. Tony, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, I just want to play these clips again. The LBJ Library just released this stuff a couple of years ago. And so, most people have never heard these before. But this is public domain stuff. It's from the Lyndon Johnson Library, the LBJ Library. And these are from 1964, May 27, 1964, three telephone conversations LBJ had. Now, keep in mind, the Vietnam War was just getting going. I mean, it was just getting going. I'm not sure when the Gulf of Tonkin resolution was. I'd have to go back and look. But listen to these. Each one is a little less than a minute. These three conversations, these with Adlai Stevenson, McGeorge Bundy, and Senator Richard Russell. Stevenson and Bundy, I think McGeorge Bundy was his Secretary of State, maybe? I'm not sure. And Adlai Stevenson, I'm not sure what he was at that point. He had been a candidate for president a number of times. In any case, here's the conversations with LBJ about Vietnam.
Bring me over there.
That'd be fine.
And you be thinking about it. I want to have some talks with you. And if you get free, you just pick up the phone and call sometime.
All right, sir. Fine.
I want to. I shudder at getting too deeply involved there, and everybody thinks that's the only alternative.
Well, I've been shuddering on this thing for 3 years, and I'm afraid we're in a position now where you don't have any alternative, and it's a hell of an alternative. And it really gives me the shakes. But I don't know. He was going to give me all the up-to-date planning.
So the Gulf of Tonkin was in August. This is before the Gulf of Tonkin. Listen to this.
I think we ought to plan that basis. I'll tell you, the more I just stayed awake last night thinking about this thing, the more I think of it, I don't know what in the hell... It looks like me we're getting into another Korea. It just worries the hell out of me. I don't see what we can ever hope to get out of there with once we're committed. I believe the Chinese communists coming into it. I don't think that we can fight them 10,000 miles away from home and ever get anywhere in that area. I don't think it's worth fighting for, and I don't think we can get out. And it's just the biggest damn mess.
It's an awful mess.
And we just got to think about it. I look at this sergeant of mine this morning. Got six little old kids over there, and he's getting out my things and bringing me in my night reading and all that kind of stuff. And I just thought about ordering those kids in there, and what in the hell am I ordering him out there for?
One thing
that
is
Vietnam worth to me. What is Laos worth to me? What is it worth to this country?
We
got a treaty, but hell, everybody else got a treaty out there, and they're not doing anything about it.
Yeah.
Now, of course, if you start running the communists, they may just chase you right into your own kitchen.
So he's got Adlai Stevenson with George Bundy saying, go for it, do it. He's very reluctant. This is 64.
Well, think about it, and I'll talk to you again. I hate to bother you, but I've just...
God knows I do, because it's a terrific quandary that we're in over there, just
We're just in the quicksands up to our very next. I just don't know what the hell is the best way to do about it.
I love you, and I'll be calling you.
I'll see you soon.
And that was Senator Richard Russell at Lyndon Johnson. He finally found somebody who would agree with him on this, but very ambivalent. This was 3 months before the Gulf of Tonkin. So, I mean, it's pretty amazing. You listen to these tapes. But the most amazing one is when, in 4 years later, Johnson had negotiated peace, and Richard Nixon blew it up. And at that point, we'd only lost, you know, 20,000-plus soldiers, not over 50,000. And we had killed fewer than a million Vietnamese. And this is before it really, really cranked up. Anyhow, Dave in Chicago, and none of this is to exonerate LBJ, or I'm not trying to, you know, put a patina on history, say he's a good guy, a bad guy, whatever. I just think the historical record stands on its own, and people need to know what it is. Dave in Chicago, listen on CPT. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey, I have an idea, and I think we're going about this the minimum wage thing all wrong. You could take care of those guys and say, you know, I think you were talking before about the teenage unemployment. Keep the wages where they're at and institute a 100% recovery tax on all of the programs that these Walmarts and McDonald's exploit.
That's a great idea. That's a great idea. If any of your employees are on food stamps or any other form of government assistance, you must pay the government back for that. That's a brilliant idea, Dave.
100%, and then through osmosis, I think they would actually just raise it, pay on their own.
Yeah.
And then anybody under 18, you know, there that would cover all the you know, all the kids that the guy's supposedly worried about, which I don't believe in for a second. But,
yeah, and you know, the 18-year-old who's still living at home, he's not going to be on food stamps, and so the company doesn't have to pay any recovery tax. That's absolutely brilliant. Dave, thank you very much for sharing. I'm telling you, we got the smartest listeners on earth who listen to this program. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Liz, you want to talk about money and speech?
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah, and it's been a great show today. And
thank you.
And I wanted to give a heads up to Mike Papantonio, but maybe you can speak to him. I have two things. First of all, about Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, I think that he can resolve it. And if you tell him this, a simple non-pro-tunc. I was a clerk for 30 years, so I know how to do these things. When a clerk makes an error, well, if you read the history of that Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific, the clerk had been the ex-president of the Southern Pacific Railroad.
I know. I'm the one who discovered that and put it in a book.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, that's right. That's right. So the way they could correct it is by going back to that judicial district and filing a non-pro-tunc and overturning it because he had a conflict of interest. He didn't follow the judge's order.
You mean change the head note. You can change a head note.
I don't know. I think you can vacate the order.
Because the case did not decide that corporations are persons. In fact, if you read the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific 1886 decision, in the last four or five paragraphs of the decision, they say, the majority opinion says, the issue of other constitutional issues were raised, and we did not employ them because we were able to find a solution, a remedy under California law. Now, Stephen Jay Field wrote a dissent in which he complained that the corporations were not acknowledged as persons. So you wouldn't want to overturn the decision. It was the clerk's notes in the headnote, which has no legal standing. It was the clerk's notes in the head note where he said corporations are persons. And the clerk was I think it was the Baltimore and Ohio Railroad. It was not the Southern Pacific Railroad. He was the president for a very short time of a Northeastern Railroad. It's in my book, Unequal Protection. Liz, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks to you all for another great day. We will see you tomorrow, same time, same place. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.